Hi, this is Sylvia Massey. I'm with Nate Goyer and the Vinyl Guide. Go out there and make some noise.
Well, don't worry, Sylvia. We're about to. Hey, everyone, it's Nate, host of the Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in this week. It's a great one. As you've heard, we are welcoming special guest Sylvia Massey, producer, engineer, mixer, author, recording guru, microphone collector, I can go on and on and on. Today, Sylvia and I discuss a myriad of topics. She tells tales of working with the likes of Johnny Cash, Tool, Prince, and more. Extremely interesting stories and insight on those artists and being in the creative environment with them. Also, Sylvia just purchased the largest microphone collection in the world. She collects microphones like many of us collect records, and you can tell she's extremely passionate about recording. Plus, we also talk about Sylvia's book, Recording Unhinged, which is an amazing reading experience, very informative. Anyone who's even remotely interested in recording audio should check this out. You could find a copy of Recording Unhinged at all major book websites, or more directly, just go to sylviamassey.com and pick up your copy there. And I do want to point out that there is an extended interview with Sylvia available only to our Patreon supporters at patreon.com/vinylguide. I put a lot of extended interviews up there, more info, more stories, secret episodes, and those are only available to our patrons. Now, if you want to become one, that's easy. Just go to patreon.com/vinylguide. Help support the show and get access to all sorts of cool stuff. Also, a quick shout out to our show patrons. You guys are friggin' awesome. And hey, we have some new ones we want to welcome into the fold this week, including Carolina Hidalgo, John Raptus, Patrick Thompson, Eric Lands, and Brian King. Thank you so much for supporting the Vinyl Guide podcast. You guys kick ass. And again, please enjoy this week's extended interview. Now, as a treat to the listeners, I left a little bit of audio at the beginning of the interview that you may enjoy. As we began our session, I got about a 10-minute video glimpse into Sylvia's studio and got to see her and her studio manager, Chris, set up a vintage microphone, which she used to record her end of today's conversation. Of course, her and Chris are plugging in and out cables, taking levels, checking things and everything, and it was fascinating to me, not only as an audio nerd, but just to be able to watch a master at work. So I left a little bit of that banter early in the interview. Hope you guys enjoy it. Also, understanding that because Sylvia is our guest this week, we may have more audiophiles and audio nerds listening than usual. I wanted to explain we have a slight echo on some of Sylvia's responses. And that's where we had a slight vocal overlap in the audio tracks where we pressed them together to make it seem like we're in the same room. Sylvia recorded her end of the interview out of Oregon on this vintage microphone. My end was in Sydney on my microphone, but we slapped them together and it sounds like we're in the same room, even though we're 12,000 kilometers and an ocean away. Look, I doubt it takes anything away from the experience, but again, just knowing there's more audio nerd ears listening than usual, just wanted to share that with you. Now, this episode is brought to you in part by our friends at AudiophileUSA.com. Now, if you're a record collector, you know that condition is everything. And AudiophileUSA.com not only ships worldwide, but they also stock only excellent and near mint vinyl records. None of this G, VG plus, VG minus crap. Nope, they just do excellent and near mint vinyl records. Somehow the guys just find the cleanest records I've ever seen. I mean, some of them are in original shrink wrap. Some of them are still sealed, like decades old store stock that's been languishing somewhere in a box since Reagan was president. And they make it available at AudiophileUSA.com. Go up there, you can find your final upgrade on some of these classic titles. I do it regularly. I encourage you to do the same. It's a great service. They're family-owned and operated, and they ship worldwide. What else do you need? AudiophileUSA.com. Go there now and find your holy grail. Now, we're also brought to you this week by the greatest record cleaner in the world, the Groove Washer. You have records, they need cleaning. Why not just get the best? Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record shop and accept no substitutes. You have no idea where those fluids are coming from. The groove washer is made in the USA and designed for record cleaning and long-term vinyl storage. You don't want to make the mistake of putting some weird liquid on your record only to find out years later that it was a huge mistake. Get the groove washer from your local record shop or go to groovewasher.com, and here's a 10% off promo code VinylGuide10. Enter that at checkout. Get 10% off everything at groovewasher.com. That's promo code VinylGuide10, groovewasher.com, proud to be made in the USA. And with the upfronts done, let's get into today's conversation with Sylvia Massey, already in progress.
Yeah, okay, and everything is working now. This beauty is...
And which microphone is this again? RCA which?
It's an RCA... KU3A.
KU-3A.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, watch and, out.
Is that is that one built in the U.S. like around the 40s or 50s, that sort of thing?
Yes, 50s. This was a kind of a later design for RCA. Yeah, let me get back to the other camera here. All right. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Nate. Sorry about that, and we're actually recording right now.
No, that's great. No, watching you go through that, it's like watching, you know, Da Vinci painting. I'm just going to be quiet, and I'm going to watch the master at work here.
All right. So. Thank you, so, Mr. Johnson. Thank you, Chris Johnson.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Love you, Nate.
I love you back. All right.
So, all right.
Sylvia, I have been absolutely pining for this conversation, and especially after reading the book, Recording Unhinged. I mean, I think it should be... really required reading for every music engineer. Is this the life lessons? Is this what we're going to get instead of an autobiography?
Well, it's a chance for me to ask people to unlearn what they've been taught about recording, the proper ways to record, and then just to gain some freedom in the way that they approach the idea of recording. It should be that everyone has the freedom to try things that aren't necessarily right and see what the result is. Sometimes it works out.
It seems to me that one of your superpowers is to look at different devices or a string of devices and have an idea of what they'll sound like when they're connected. Is that fair to say?
It's helpful if you have experience on a particular piece of equipment to kind of anticipate what it can do. But I would never say to avoid things that you haven't tried. In fact, that's kind of a something that I'll try to do every day if I can. If I'm recording, I want to try something that I haven't tried before. That's the fun thing about going to new places and working in new studios. As I look around the room, the first time I walk into a new studio, and I take a beeline to the equipment that I don't know, just so I can try it, you know, possibly try it if it's appropriate.
And by seeing a microphone, like I know you just bought this tremendous collection of microphones. How many of them were in this collection, by the way?
Well, I had a collection of about 300 mics, vintage mics to begin with, but this added another... Oh, probably around 1,800 to 2,000 mics. We just finished the main inventory, but there are a few left in boxes that we haven't quite dug out yet. So it's a massive, massive collection. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll keep us busy for a while. I have to say that it's not quite enough, though, because there are gaps in... Bob Paquette's collection that I think need to be filled. So I'm still buying mics. I'm looking for Soviet mics and some Czech mics. There's French mics that are not in the collection. A lot of international mics. There's Australian mics too. But I have managed to find a few of the Zephyrs and the Steens sound system vintage mics.
In that case, with so many microphones, you got so much choice there. Does that become a bit of a barrier sometimes?
Well, I have to say, even just this morning while we're trying to set up a mic for this podcast, I'm in the room with, you know, 2,000 microphones, and then all of a sudden, well, what am I going to use? And Luckily, there's several, most of the mics I can't use because I don't have the correct connectors for them, or their cabling has been cut. So there's a few choice mics that I'll run towards first, and that's where this RCA KU3A mic, I thought, well, I know I can plug that in right away, so here we go.
Okay. Now, I get the feeling, correct me if I'm wrong, but I get the feeling that you're likely so busy with your studio and recording and then hooking up all these gadgets and doodads, you don't have a lot of time to sit and simply listen to music. Would I be right in that?
It's, you know, it's a challenge to listen to music, but I have this week listened to some of my favorite music from the past, just to re-inspire me, including some Depeche Mode. I had to listen to some classics just to wet my whistle, so to speak.
What's your preferred way of listening to music? Is it vinyl? Is it digital? How do you listen to music?
Right now, the easiest way is just through my computer speakers because the new studio is not really set up completely yet. But soon it will be the best way to listen, obviously, in the studio environment with the Genelec 8351As. I also have some big 1035As. And that they're mounted in the walls here in the new studio. And those are active now. We're planning on setting up an Atmos system here. And Genelec will provide the speakers for the entire studio. And that will make it'll be one of the nicest listening environments on the west side of the United States, for sure. Yeah.
What are some examples of recordings where you listen to the mix, not ones that you've done, but by your peers and people in the industry that you listen to and you feel is as close to perfect as can be?
I think that one of the most recent tracks that I listened to for comparison is Pretender by Foo Fighters is a favorite because of its energy and the good sound of the drums. The frequency range is not a pure high to low frequency, but it gives me a really good idea of the commercial range that sounds good coming out of an iPhone or computer speakers as well as the home speakers. In the past, I've listened to Bob Clear Mountain mixes, which I love. Some of the Crowded House stuff that he's done. And like I just listened to this morning, the Depeche Mode Policy of Truth, I think that just has an amazing sonic spectrum that I try to match the spectrum, not necessarily the sound, but the spectrum.
The whole Violator album is that
way. Isn't it great? Yeah.
When you're working with artists, do you prepare differently for like a heavy band versus a country band? Are there any routines or things that you do as a lead-in for those sessions?
I like to have everyone in the same room when I'm recording. So the first thing I'll try to do is understand what they're trying to achieve with the recording and then accommodate that. If possible, I'll put everyone in the same room so that they can see each other and communicate in the way that musicians do when they're working together. I think it's difficult to capture a genuine performance when everyone is either in separate rooms or tracks are done one at a time. So it really depends on if we have a working band that, like recently I worked with an artist named Carolyn Sills and her combo, and they play out and they play country swing music, and they need that communication between each other. So I wanted them all in the same room, and I isolated the guitar cabinets and the live bass cabinet in a separate room. Actually, we were out in the desert in Mojave, in the Mojave Desert, literally, in a pink house, and all the cabinets were in a storage container out in the desert while we were recording. And everyone was in the same room, which is a way I love to work, even me and the equipment. I love to work in the same room with people and just working with headphones typically. But it really depends on the artist. Some artists are doing everything themselves, and in that case, I have to approach the project completely differently, because we will be piecing it together. One thing I do to prepare for any project is I would like to hear rough mixes of the songs we'll be working on, whether they're just simple voice message recordings, or if they're, you know, semi-produced, to give me an idea of where they would like to go with it. That's good too. But I want to know what the song is about so that I can make judgments quickly and be in the right direction when we start.
So do you then form a vision about what you believe the final product would sound like, or are you still largely exploring during that process too?
Well, before we meet to start recording, I'll ask them several questions about what they're trying to achieve. And I'll also feel out how much help they need from me and in what areas they need. So as we begin, I'll listen to their music, I'll make comments, and then I can find out right away how much help they need and where I fit into the picture. Some artists will let me just take off and do whatever I feel and really put my imprint on their music. There was an artist in Prague that I worked with last year named Adrian T. Bell, and he gave me the freedom. He's a brilliant writer, but he didn't get in the way. He just said, do what you want to do. And I said, well, I want some strings and I want, you know, some backing vocals here. And I want live bells from a bell tower here. And he says, okay, we'll make it happen. And we did everything. And it's one of the favorite projects of my entire career. On other projects, I might just be someone who's documenting what a band does themselves. Like Tool, for instance, is such a great live band. My job was just to document what they do on stage and capture it in the studio as an engineer. And then I also gave them my ideas for improving songs or additional instrumentation. So I did get a production credit on that record, but I played a much different role in that production than I did in other albums where I'm really heavily involved in the writing arrangements. So yeah, it varies from project to project.
So it sounds like your role could also evolve in a project. It could start as engineering and mix, and then you find that open door to be able to start providing some input, and they're eager to take it, and that moves you to a different level of collaboration.
I guess that's always my intent, is to find a crack and then, you know, open it up and get in there and really work on the project to make it better. It doesn't always happen, though. You know, some people really have their vision, and then it's my job to make that image in their head real, you know. So it's the best job in the world, I have to say. It's just either way, I'm absolutely happy to work with good musicians and good music.
So let's talk about some of the projects you've worked on. Let's go to Rick Rubin. How did you start working with Rick Rubin?
Rick and I started working together at Larrabee Sound, where I was working in LA as an assistant engineer. We had projects in common. I had produced earlier. I had produced an album in San Francisco before I moved to LA of a band called the Sea Hags, And Rick actually loved the Sea Hags and really wanted to work with them also. So we kind of connected on the Sea Hags at first. And then from that, he started giving me jobs, and his partner, George DeCoulias, also had me work on some Black Crowes masters. And it finally led to working with Rick on and off for about 7 years, different projects between System of a Down and Johnny Cash, with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers as Johnny's backup band, which was unbelievable sessions. That was the Unchained album. And I also, what else did I do? I did so much with him. We did some Danzig, several projects.
I saw you had a credit on the Ghetto Boys. Tell me about the Ghetto Boys, because we actually had Willie D on the show at one point, and he was talking about when the call came in from Deaf American. They sent the tapes. They weren't even in the room when that happened. Is that your recollection as well?
Well, my participation in the Ghetto Boys was very early with my connection to Rick. So he brought in masters, and we sat and listened to them. It was my job to put it all in order and to do crossfades and stuff on the masters. I never met the band. But I'll never forget Rick just beaming from ear to ear on how proud he was of that record and how shocking the lyrics were at the time. It was all, you know, rap music was more about Adidas and, you know, at the time. And this shook up that whole thing. That was quite a shocking change in rap with the Ghetto Boys.
Right, okay. So there was no tracking. It was really more of a mix job. Okay. And with Johnny Cash, the Unchained album, was Johnny up for the sort of recording experimentation that you've become known for, or was it much more traditional?
The most experimental part of the Johnny record was having Johnny singing modern rock songs. Mm-hmm. He sang a Beck song. He sang a Soundgarden song, you know, and Rick, this was entirely Rick Rubin's idea, and Rick Rubin chose the material to be recorded. So I thought that was an amazing way of putting together something special to revive Johnny's career. And bringing in Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, the entire Heartbreaker band, and so many other players. There was Lindsey Buckingham and Mick Fleetwood and Carl Perkins and Flea. And there was just all these. It was star-studded. Every day I would look over my shoulder at the couch in the back of the room and see some other rock star there. It was amazing. But what I tried to do as the engineer on that project was to capture a sound that was the best for Johnny's voice, and that was to use vintage equipment to emulate an old-timey recording. And I did that by putting his vocal, setting up a vocal chain that included a Telefunken U-47 and a stay-level compressor chained into a Urey 1176, so two compressors, or limiter compressors, and then we recorded it on a Neve 8028 console with 1084 EQs. So we had a kind of a combination of 50s, 40s, 70s kind of equipment to give it a kind of a grainy, mid-rangey sound. And all the other instruments were all also recorded on the old Neve console. So it gave it a vibe, and it's bone dry too. There was nothing artificial about it. That's Rick Rubin's style. I learned so much from him on the art of production.
It would seem like a lot of your recording techniques that you outlined in the book, a lot of it is about distraction and getting the artist outside of their comfort zone and then exploring what the possibilities are from them. Was that a Rick Rubin lesson there?
That's a lesson that I learned just from years of working with vocalists and being a vocalist myself, it's difficult for a vocalist to detach themselves from their instrument. You know, you could tune a guitar. You could put one guitar down and pick up another guitar if it doesn't sound right. You can correct your fretting on the fretboard, but your vocals, if your vocals aren't together, the vocalist is just not going to be right, you know. And there's things I can do to correct it, but it's much better to have the initial performance be real and genuine. So what I've found is that distraction helps quite a bit. If I give the singer, while we're recording a vocal track, if I give them several jobs that have nothing to do with the task at hand, it seems to help. So I might say to them, okay, think about expressing yourself with your hands. Every time you sing a verse, I want you to use your hands like an angry Italian, you know. Come on, really express yourself through your hands and through your face and through your body, and go ahead and lunge and jump up and down. It doesn't matter, because all that, if I can get just a few phrases from a good performance, a real performance, it's going to make all the difference. So I oftentimes will give a singer a chance to do it their way. And then I'll say, okay, let's just erase all that. Let's try something new. I want to give you this job. Sometimes I'll have them just spontaneously change the melody. Okay, because sometimes the singer has a melody so stuck in their head on a song that they've been performing for a while that it to give them the job of changing that melody is without having time to really work on it. It just opens up it opens the floodgates. Suddenly they have this freedom to ad lib and to add more. And so there's amazing things happen when you allow the singer to be free, if you just uncage them for that.
Wow, there's a lot of psychology behind that.
It's
part Jeff Emmerich, part Dr. Phil. How do you know when you have the best performance you're going to get from an artist?
There's usually an arc, a curve to a singer's performance. The first couple takes of a song usually have a fire that gets lost after several times of recording the same part. So what I like to do is initially, once I get the microphone levels set, I'll record from top to bottom, and I might not even have it entirely set. I'll just say, okay, sing the song. I'll be adjusting the equipment. And I'll, as quickly as possible, adjust the levels while they're basically warming up. And that warm up usually has such fire that I'll be using a good deal of it in the end comp. So we'll do one take from beginning to end while I'm, quote, making adjustments.
The pressure's off.
Yeah, right. The pressure's off. And then I'll say, okay, now let's do it for real. And then I'll get a different performance, you know, a more controlled performance and a more, you can hear it in the voice when a singer is thinking about their throat. And then as we work, maybe the third time or the fourth time, I'll ask them, all right, this time I want you to tell the story of this song. If the singer has actually written the lyric, then I want them to really communicate to me personally, one-to-one, what the song is about through the words, whether it's, you know, changing it into more of a speaking voice or it doesn't, and I let them know it doesn't matter if it's usable or not. Let's just do this exercise to get you in the mindset of telling a story. And then I'll take piece by piece after that, and I'll make sure that I have everything I want out of each phrase in the song. So we'll work on a verse, we might work on a few words, and I'll do three or four takes of each individual phrase. Now, at the end of that, I'll let the singer take a break. But while we have been recording, I typically have in my Pro Tools session the comments window open, and I have been taking notes during all this recording, and I'll put a star on V1, meaning there's a good verse one here, and I'll put a star, two stars or three stars on the bridge here, and then it's so easy for me at the end to do a quick comp because I have all my notes right in front of me, bam, 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 bam. And then we listen to the first comp, and then we'll take and detail some parts of that first comp. If the singer is unhappy with a verse, we'll re-sing it, or I'll just recomp with what we've already got. So in general, there's probably three full takes on any song, and then a lot of pieces as we're building a track.
So for Johnny, at that point, I think he was well into his 70s, so his voice probably wasn't as strong as some of the younger artists you were used to working with. Was that a process of capturing? You maybe had one or two opportunities to get Johnny down, or was he up for a full day of work?
You know, that was very true about all of the players on the Johnny Cash record. Basically, the moment that those sessions started, the moment that they sat down and started playing together, the tape, and we were using 24-track Studers at the time, the tape was rolling because the first take was going to be the take. Amazing players. I mean, and if I had said to them, okay, I got my levels now, let's do it for real. Well, I would have been out of there in a second.
Right.
It was very important to have every level ready. And the moment those people sat down, that we were going to capture it. Johnny, in particular, I did do overdubs with later. And I went to Nashville and worked at the Cowboy Arms Hotel and Recording Spa. And we recorded, and that was where Johnny had done a lot of recording in the past. So he felt comfortable there, and we spent a couple days there finishing off the record. There wasn't a lot of recording needed, though. I mean, really, the guy's iconic voice and his ability to tell a story was just, it was hard to find anything wrong with most of what he was doing, except for the songs he was not that familiar with. We had to take some extra time with.
Yeah, and I would imagine the frailness of his voice was actually an asset at that point.
Yeah, well, you just wanted to hug him. He was precious, you know? Yeah.
Another part of your career that fascinates me is Green Jello. This is a band that I loved from the get-go, and I understand you got involved with Green Jello through connections at Tower Records. Can you tell me about that?
When I was first starting out, I lived in San Francisco, and I wound up doing a lot of music productions in San Francisco, but I realized that if I really wanted to make a go of it, that I needed to move to Los Angeles. So even with as much experience as I had, when I landed in Los Angeles, I had a very difficult time finding a job in any studio. So I wound up taking a job at Tower Records. It was probably the best thing I could have done, because everyone at Tower is basically a musician trying to get into the industry.
And this is the Tower on the Sunset Strip. This is the one.
This was one of the most iconic landmarks on the Sunset Strip, and it was the Tower Records that Axl Rose and Slash worked in before they had their big break. And so everyone was a musician, and everyone had their own story to tell. So I connected with these people, and there was a band that part of them had moved from Buffalo, New York, and I suggested that we record. I knew someone with an 8-track, and so we went in to record their album. It was Green Jello, the first Los Angeles version of Green Jello. And we did an album in a couple days, I guess. Mm-hmm. And a label was very interested. It was a label through BMG, and it was a label...
Zoo, I believe.
Zoo, right. Lumalia. And that record sold like crazy. It was a shocker because I was still on staff at Larrabee Sound, and my boss ran into the office where we were, and he had the billboard in his hand, and he says, "Look, you're number 24 on the singles chart," and that was with that song "Three Little Pigs" in it, and I was like, "Wow, I guess that's good." And he's like, "Oh my God, that's so good!" So that really kickstarted my career. It was comedy, you know. It was a comedy record, and so I still to this day love music with a sense of humor. I think it's important for people to not take themselves so seriously, you know.
So, Serial Killer soundtrack, that was recorded on an 8-track.
The original album was on an 8-track, but we re-recorded it at Sound City. The re-recording had some new players on it, including Danny Carey, who's the drummer from Tool. He was playing drums. There were two drummers, actually, and Danny was one of them. And Maynard James Keenan, the singer from Tool, had some vocal parts that he did. Actually, he's the voice of "Not by the Hair of My Chinny Chin Chin" on the song, in the Three Little Pigs song. And so while we were at Sound City, Zoo suggested that we record the initial Tool album too, the EP, the initial five or six songs, I guess.
There was Opiate.
Yeah, it was Opiate. So Danny's drums were set up, so we recorded that first Tool record there.
Oh, okay. So that was part of the Green Jello sessions, was it? Yeah. A couple of tracks mixed
the studio
with some live tracks.
With some live, yeah. And secretly, I kind of edited between the live and the studio.
And Tool, at that point, they had signed a deal with Zoo. So that EP was their first release. What was the conversation around the goals, the objective of that EP? Was it to lay the groundwork for the album or just to test the waters?
I think it was test the waters. They had a lot of material that they had been playing for a while, and that's the stuff that was first recorded in the EP on Opiate. But when it came to Undertow, there was a lot of new material, including songs that were not written until we went into the studio. So they wrote songs in the studio while we were on the clock, basically. Several of them.
I know Disgustipated was written in the studio.
Yeah, right.
Which other tracks were written in the studio?
I think Flood was the second set of sessions. There were two sets of sessions, 5 months apart, because they didn't have enough material to put out and to finish the record in the first session. So there was a lot of writing going on. What's the first song of the record? I forget.
Lie, Cheat, and Steal, whatever that.
Right.
Boy.
Nah. I'm embarrassed that I don't know it.
I never know names of songs.
And plus, the names of songs change between recording them and actually releasing them, too.
Intolerance.
That's it. Intolerance was written in the studio.
Were you part of the recording of the live set that they did at the Jello Loft that became part of Opiate?
Yes. We did a recording in a remote truck on a beautiful little API console, and that was a lot of fun. That was at the Jello Loft, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and I believe it was on a New Year's Eve, so they were probably one of several bands that were there.
Yeah, right.
Oh, okay.
Quite a party.
And I imagine they had a full set, so somewhere out there is a recording of about 7 or 8 other tracks that they played that night.
That's right.
All right, we'll have to wait for the box set on that one there.
Right.
When you're doing a mix, how do you know when it's time to stop tinkering?
Yeah, that's the biggest question for any mixer. There's a story about mixing that I'll share with you. And it's when I was working with Prince for, I worked with him for about 3 years during the early parts of my time in Los Angeles. And he gave me a mix to do one day. I worked in several roles for him. Sometimes I was assisting projects. Sometimes I was engineering. Sometimes I was mixing. But he gave me a mix one day, and he says, here's the song. And he gave me a 2-inch tape. And then he left. And so I started working on it. It was about a 7-minute long song. And I worked on it, and I mixed it, and I did all these drops, and I really worked on it to get it so he would love it. I wanted him to just love it. And there was that point when I knew it was done, but Prince hadn't shown up yet to take a listen. So the question was, do I continue working or not? And I thought to myself, well, it feels finished to me. It feels like maybe I could do more, maybe I could add something, or maybe I could create another part, but it would have just been unnecessary at that point. So once I started doing things that were not making it better, I just stopped, and then I sat out on the couch and waited for him to show up.
So you were able to catch yourself in that moment.
Yes, I did. However, when he showed up with a girl. And I was like, okay, great. I can play him this mix. And I followed him into the studio, and he turned around and he says, nah, I won't need you. And I was like, okay. He knew how to run all the equipment without me needing to help him. So, I sat outside and waited, you know, I could hear the music through the door, and, him and a girl were listening to the song. It was about 7 minutes long, and then it was silence and silence and silence. I was like, okay, well, then he and the girl come busting out of the room, all with their hair messed up and stuff, and they just walked out the front door, and never even a peep about the mix. It wasn't about the mix. It was about something else.
So, there's a lot to unpack there. So Prince, I mean, such a genius. He seems to have really had talent, extreme talent in so many different areas, musically, performance, but also mixing, production, everything. What do you think was, what do you think his weak spot was? What do you think the area was that he needed more help in from a professional like yourself or somewhere?
Yes. Well, you know, here's a person that was the most prolific writer that I can think of, you know, amazing performer, terrible communicator, just could not really express himself without being condescending, I guess. He was very difficult to be friendly with, and he would often expect you to read his mind on what he wanted. He was not good at expressing what he wanted. I think that was probably the most difficult thing for him. He also never slept, so it would have been nice, actually, as someone who worked with him for such a long time, that he would take some nights off, because it would be 4 a.m. I'd be getting the call, come to the studio, you know. So, and anyone who's worked for Prince can tell you this similar story.
So it sounds like people around him, including yourself, lived in a state of, I'll say, apprehension. Like, did I
apprehension
do
is did a I very not? Good word for it. Yeah.
Where do I stand?
Oh, yeah. No one knew anything. And oftentimes, you didn't even know if he was in town. I would be working and then finish a project and then be waiting for him to show up. And then the management would finally call and say, hey, you guys, you could go home. He's in Paris, you know. It's like, okay. But we all got paid well. We all got great credits for what we were working on. But I have to say, he, in Los Angeles, he had two studios at Larrabee, two studios at the record plant, running all the time. It may have been three studios at the record plant, running all the time with an engineer in each room. And he would bounce between sessions. And generally, there were two songs written, recorded, produced, and mixed in each room every day. So if he had five rooms going, he was finishing 10 songs a day between with the help of all these engineers. Can you imagine what's in that and in his archive? You know, so much material that has never been heard.
I mean, it's hard to even make release schedules off that sort of thing. You'd have an album coming out every month.
I think that Warner Brothers was actually kind of upset about that because he would continually change albums that they would approve, get mastered, and have ready to go to production. And then he would replace the songs and put new songs on it. They were always butting heads about that.
Do you have an approach for mixing to vinyl? Do you have some deliberate differences between, okay, here's a streaming mix, here's a CD mix, here's a vinyl mix?
I haven't really done that, anything special for that. But I do work with a mastering engineer who's very specialized in cutting vinyl. And there is a few things that traditionally have been guidelines for mixing for vinyl, and that is that your low-end frequencies aren't all packed on one side or the other. Otherwise, your needle will jump out of the groove. But typically, I'll keep it as full frequency as I can.
Do vinyl records play, or even shellac records, play a role in your creation or audio or production? For instance, most engineers and artists, I think, see vinyl as a form of output. But like Amon Tobin, Billy Gould, Jared Bloom, they will use vinyl as an input, sampling, mixing, distorting, twisting. Any of that happen in your studio?
Well, you know, the thing that I appreciate the most about vinyl today and why I support vinyl releases as often as possible is that I'm a visual artist in my core, and I get to hold that thing in my hand, and whatever the artwork is on the cover becomes such an important part of the whole package of how I feel about the music. It's also a way of communicating their message, just like all the Hypnosis album covers that were with the Pink Floyd. And one of the things that really were formative in my early career were dub reggae records, and these were we traded like treasure, you know, because they were unusual, and like King Tubby records and Sly and Robbie records. And it was through dub reggae music that I learned how the studio becomes an instrument. That is, that the engineer in the studio is as important a musician to making the music as any of the other players, which really inspired me to want to do this. So that those records are so important in how I became an engineer and producer.
Mm-hmm. Were there a lot of records in your house as a youth?
Absolutely. I think I had the largest collection of anyone. I had every Zappa record, you know. I had a huge dub reggae collection. And I worked at record stores all through my youth.
Oh. You seem to also have a very skilled background in engineering. I don't mean audio engineering, but actual electricity and that sort of. Were you a student of that? Where did you pick that up?
My father was he would build his own stereo equipment, So I grew up in a household where he built tape recorders, and he set me in front of a microphone when I was two and put the tape recorder, the Ico that he had built, on sound, and so it would just be this repeating delay. And me as a kid would just make goo goo gaga sounds into this for hours, and I still have these tapes, amazingly enough. But
oh, is he a musician or
no? But my mother was the musician in the family. Actually, my father was the electronics and the builder, and my mother was a opera singer. So I had both sides. It was the perfect storm for creating someone like me. And today, you know, I'm still building electronic things. Like I'm working on this studio, and the studio's not complete yet until I solder about 20 of these connectors that I'm holding up here. They're DB25 connectors. I have to solder these cables to make them work, and then crimp a bunch of Elcos for the patch bay. I've got a lot of work to do. It's not nearly as fun as making the music, but it's necessary.
Oh, to me, that is a great afternoon. throwing on the tunes and just getting a soldering gun or just doing something nerdy with an end goal of making great music. That is
an
afternoon well spent.
Yeah.
So Sylvia, I'm going to let you go for your afternoon of soldering guns and hopefully safety equipment. I want to remind the audience to head over to sylviamassey.com. There you could check out so many videos, links to get her book, Recording Unhinged. It is a feat of genius. Get yourself a copy of this. Great, marvelous illustrations. You made the illustrations. Recording Unhinged, available at sylviamassey.com. Lots more there. Check out her new microphone collection. Lots of pictures of that. And it's always fun to keep up with what you're up to, Sylvia. Thanks for joining us here on the show.
Thank you very much, Nate.
That was fantastic. Thank you so much, Sylvia, for coming on The Vinyl Guide and sharing all those tips and tricks and stories with us. I want to remind everyone that there is an extended interview with Sylvia up on our Patreon site, patreon.com/vinylguide. Join us there. Help us support the show. Get some extra content. Everyone wins. Also, make sure to check out Recording Unhinged. It is absolutely delightful, full of illustrations. It is fascinating for anyone remotely interested in recording. You can find that at all regular book sites, wherever you get your books, or you can pick one up at sylviamassey.com. That's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Hey, you know what? We've got hundreds more of these up on our website at thevinylguide.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Sonnet, wherever you get your podcasts. There we am. Check out The Vinyl Guide. We've got a huge catalog of back episodes you're sure to enjoy. So we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.